desperate changes need to happen because so far it seems the Tories are heavy on excuses and light on solutions.
On the cusp of a new year, there are many challenges awaiting the average British family. Whoever is in charge in Downing Street, it's the most vulnerable who continue to pay the heaviest price. Without firm solutions from the political class, it seems the upcoming period might hold still more pain for those who can ill afford it. Amina Taylor, London.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counter-strike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China. Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that, more than $300 billion, is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex. Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
It was a referendum that would change Britain's future forever. 52% of those who turned out to vote in 2016 chose to leave the EU, setting to motion years of negotiations and changes to laws and legislation. The man championing the cause, Nigel Farage.
We will be leaving this prison of nations at the end of January. And we won't become a third country, as I've been hearing this morning. No, we're going to become an independent, self-governing nation.
A nation that voted in Brexiteer-in-chief, former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, to power, who promised an oven-ready post-Brexit deal with the EU and prosperity for Britons. 6 years on and five prime ministers later, the country is facing an economic downturn, expected to last until 2024, and a de facto general strike by public sector workers over pay and conditions.
Small and large businesses up and down the country have been feeling the impact of Brexit in different ways, from added paperwork on borders to shortages of labor. In October, a Confederation of British Industry report said that three-quarters of UK companies have been hit by labor shortages in the past year.
Since the new Brexit rules took effect at the start of 2021, EU nationals no longer have the freedom to work in the UK. Instead, a new points-based immigration system has been implemented to attract skilled workers. Marlies Hazelton has lived here for nearly 40 years.
I can't even get citizenship, and it feels a bit like an insult, because I'm part and parcel of this country, really. I'm part of the furniture, and I've lost that sense of home.
The UK's withdrawal from the EU has also impacted the country's trade. After the pandemic, trade in almost all G7 nations has been recovering. The one exception is the UK, thanks to the Northern Ireland Protocol.
You can compare Britain with what's going on in Europe, you see, because they've also suffered the Ukraine shock. They've suffered that. So we can look at the data and see how Britain is doing relative to the average of those EU countries that are most similar to us. And it's those statistics that show that the British economy is 4% smaller, investment about 10% smaller than it would otherwise be.
The predictions for next year's GDP growth show a similar story. According to the OECD predictions, the British economy is not likely to grow in 2023. It's estimated to perform worse than advanced economies like China, Canada, and Japan. Even developing nations such as Indonesia are ahead of the UK. And one country below Britain is Russia, which is currently under heavy economic sanctions. As Britain faces a winter of discontent on a par with the one in 1978, it's become increasingly more evident that it's Britain that risks becoming the lame duck of the G7 due to Brexit and Brexit alone. Sai Purza, London.
Fuel prices have slightly dropped in Yemen after the release of two Yemeni fuel ships that were detained by the Saudi-led coalition earlier this week in the Red Sea. The Yemeni army issued a stern warning to Saudi Arabia and the UAE that if the ships were not released soon, military action would follow. Yemeni bus and motorbike drivers in the capital Sana'a, who make a living from public transportation, welcomed the lowering of fuel prices. They say this is going to help them cope with the fuel price hike caused by the blockade.
As you can see, I am pumping 1 liter for only 500 Yemeni riyals, whereas before it used to cost us 1,500 to 2,000 for 1 liter.
The Saudi-led coalition who are seizing Yemeni fuel ships do not respond to peaceful dialogue. They only respond to us when we decide to use our military power, and if that's the case, so be it.
Yemeni political expert says the release of the fuel ships by the Saudi-led coalition isn't enough, as Yemen will continue to struggle until Saudi Arabia and its allies completely lift the blockade and end their illegal involvement in Yemen.
Although the price of fuel has slightly dropped, we still need to look at the more pressing issue, and that is the fact that the Saudi-led coalition is still occupying Yemen. We need to reach an ultimate solution that can only come through taking decisive military actions against them. This is the only solution.
Despite falling oil prices, tensions are rising on all active battlefronts in Yemen for what could soon be a resumption of war if a political solution is not reached soon. This as Saudi Arabia and the UAE continue their militarization of strategic Yemeni islands in the Red and Arabian Sea.
The release of Yemeni fuel ships by the Saudi-led coalition marks a big victory for the Yemeni government based in Sana'a and to the people living in the areas controlled by Ansar Allah. This also indicates that Saudi Arabia and the UAE simply cannot afford to have their oil industry targeted by Yemeni ballistic missiles, which is why they chose a safer option by releasing the fuel vessels. Yusuf Mawadi, Sana'a.
...2022 has been dominated by a cost-of-living crisis, and the figures are staggering. Inflation is running at a double-digit pace, the highest in 40 years, and far outpacing wage growth. While food prices have shot up almost 20%, and the cost of heating a typical home has jumped more than 150%. As temperatures plummet below zero and desperation rises, key sector worker unions have launched mass strike actions to pressure the government to force wage rises.
The people who are out here on strike today are the same people who not only worked through the pandemic, we worked for the people. We'd get their prescriptions, we'd get their milk and bread.
We just want a pay rise in line with the cost of living. At the moment, what we're getting is actually terms of a pay cut. So it's not even in line with inflation. Everything's gone up. We're just like everybody else. We're all struggling.
This is not about pay. This is about our jobs.
The situation has become so dire in Britain that many families will have to choose whether to heat their homes or feed their families this Christmas.
It is very distressing. It's a situation which, in a way, unimaginable for a country which is supposed to be one of the richest countries in Europe and in the West. Why is it we have these extremes of poverty? Why are people, some people, forced to choose between heating and eating? I mean, there's something completely wrong about our system. We should be plugging and supporting and promoting equality and, you know, not oppressing the poor. You know, there's something which says a lot about our political system, which is flawed.
The government has pinned much of the blame on economic recovery from the COVID era. However, critics say its ruling Conservative Party incompetence and leadership instability that has also left the economy in a dire state. A lesser discussed reason for a European-wide crisis is the ongoing Ukraine war. Britain has remained a staunch supporter of continued fighting, even upping its shipments of arms and financial support.
I think the first is ensuring that we deliver more military aid and that that military aid evolves to meet the situation that we're now facing. And that means more air defence systems, it means artillery, it means armoured vehicles. For our part in the United Kingdom, we've pledged to match or exceed the £2.3 billion in aid that we provided this year, next year.
Low wages, higher fuel costs, inflation and major strike action have all marred 2022. Does the government have what it takes to resolve these many issues in 2023? Probably not. It's going to be a long road with most likely higher taxation, major cuts in public spending and renewed pressure on an already struggling British working class. Robert Carter, London.
The PTI lawmakers did not appear before the Speaker of the National Assembly for the confirmation of their resignations, which they tendered in April, following the ouster of former Prime Minister Imran Khan through a vote of no confidence. While responding to a letter written by the top leadership of Khan's party on December 15, the Speaker of the Parliament, Raja Parvez Ashraf, called PTI's MPs to appear one by one in his chamber for the legal exercise under the rules of procedures and conduct of business in the country's National Assembly, terming it as another U-turn of Imran Khan in his political career. The lawmakers belonging to treasury benches criticized the policies of the PTI party chief, saying that agenda of the former prime minister is only to politically destabilize Pakistan.
The Speaker of the National Assembly, through a written letter, asked the PTI lawmakers to come and complete the constitutional requirements for their resignations. But the PTI leadership is using the move as a political stunt. Actually, they are not ready to resign from the parliament.
While defending his party decision, the PTI leadership says that it will approach the country's top court to seek acceptance of their mass resignations instead of the parliament, and will also dissolve the assemblies in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces.
Why we are dissolving our own governed assemblies in two key provinces of the country? Because the country is heading towards destruction under the rule of an imported government. The only way to save the country is to hold free, fair and transparent elections.
Amid political tug-of-war in the country, Pakistan's former PM Imran Khan announced last week that he would go to the parliament on Thursday to confirm the resignations of his party lawmakers and dissolve the Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa assemblies on 23rd of December. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The Taliban officials on Tuesday ordered a nationwide ban on university education for Afghan women. Earlier, a letter made public by the spokesman for the Ministry of Higher Education, Ziaullah Hashimi, outlining that the measure would take effect immediately in private and public universities. Today, the Taliban forces barred women from entering Kabul University.
This piece of news was really disappointing. Last night, when I was told that the Taliban have ordered girls to be excluded from universities, I couldn't eat or sleep. After so many efforts and attending several classes in hope of making a bright future, they at once ruined everything. This order is very painful and unacceptable. It has to be reversed.
This was very shocking. Nowadays, we've been sitting our final test. Today, despite knowing that they wouldn't let us in, I rushed to the university. This is very difficult for an Afghan girl to comprehend the weight of being barred from getting education. So far, I've been worrying for my sisters who are banned from schools, and from now on, I should be concerned about my future too.
Afghan experts warn that the new order will have a devastating impact on the future of women as well as the entire Afghan nation. They urge the Taliban authorities to stop rolling back Afghan women's rights.
It is a catastrophic decision to ban women from universities. This can also be seen as a terrifying shock for Afghan society, especially the youth and women. It is so bitter and concerning. Previously, the explosion hit our girl students in tuition centers, but this devastating order is targeting the progress of a whole nation. The effects and consequences of this illogical order are unfortunate and irreparable in different arenas.
And it's difficult to imagine how a country can...
In addition to oppositions from inside Afghanistan, the United Nations and several countries have condemned the order. They have signaled that the Taliban administration won't get recognition until they equally observe the human rights of all Afghans. After taking power, the Taliban promised a softer role and upholding women's rights. But today, many here say that the Taliban have been failing to abide by their promises. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring
event.
In Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to Yemen, the humanitarian tragedy stands tall and sadly continues to claim lives and even worsen. However, on the political front, things look even dismal as well. Talks so far have not yielded any concrete results. And in terms of the truce, which ended recently, well, it's just a matter of time when an all-out war resumes. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the ceasefire talks ended in the first place and why doesn't Saudi Arabia end the blockade and stop a seizure of fuel ships as an example in order to move towards resolving the conflict overall. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the program. Hossein Bukhayti joins us. He's an activist and political commentator who joins us from Sana'a. Also joining us is Hamza Karim, Yemeni activist and political commentator who joins us from Toronto. Welcome to you both.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Hamza Karim, I'll first start with you. Taking a look at the most recent developments, I guess the Oman talks, whether it was held in Oman with the delegation that visited Sana'a, we're having the head of Yemen's national negotiating delegation, Mohammed Abdul Salam, who says that complete ceasefire can be established once the Saudi siege on Yemen is lifted, as one of the conditions that it has set forward. So just on that particular front, just on that Saudi siege, why isn't Saudi Arabia lifting that siege when it knows that the, I'm sure it's aware of how badly the humanitarian situation in Yemen is unfolding on a daily, if not an hourly basis?
Thank you. Yeah, so for the past 8 years, Saudi Arabia, as we all know, wasn't able to achieve any of the goals that they listed at the beginning of this war. And now they think that the last card that they can play with is the economical card, which is represented by lifting the blockade that is imposed by moving the bank from the capital city of Sana'a to Aden, by the blockade imposed on partially on the airport in Sana'a. So these are the cards that are left for Saudi Arabia and that they can play with. They've failed miserably when it comes to the military aspect of this war. After 8 years, they couldn't achieve anything. So I think this is the last card that Saudi Arabia can play, hoping that they can make changes or achieve any of the goals that they've set at the beginning of this war. But so far, as we can see, really after 8 years, nothing has been achieved, whether it's by using military or by using this economical card. Now, it's up to Saudi Arabia whether they're very serious about really getting into peace, which means that this war has to stop, a blockade has to be lifted, and salaries has to be paid to the Yemeni people. Nowadays, we have Saudi Arabia, they're looting and stealing Yemen's resources and selling them to foreign countries and taking this money and putting it in Al Ahli Bank in Saudi Arabia. This can't happen. This money should be used towards paying the salaries of people in Yemen, in all Yemen, whether it's the south, where Saudi Arabia and UAE are controlling part of it, or the north of Yemen. And finally, all the foreign military groups has to leave Yemen as well, if Saudi Arabia is serious about peace in Yemen. Otherwise, I don't see really the war stopping and it could come back at any point.
Hossein Abghaiti, so to sum it up, based on what our guest there said, a permanent ceasefire needs to be established based on what the Ansarullah movement has said. Once the siege against Yemen is lifted, so that's for starters, the salaries of the civil servants to then be fully paid, another condition, and then occupiers, as they call them, are completely withdrawn. The Ansarullah movement, the official Yemeni government, is very clear that those three have to be met. Do you think there's any room for compromise on the side of the Saudi front? Because they're not giving in to that. So that leaves a question mark as to their commitment to wanting a ceasefire and then for the conflict to be resolved, if any hopes of that.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's clearly now what the Saudi actually want because after more than 8 years of Saudi blockade and war on Yemen, they have actually failed military and as well they have failed politically in Yemen. We've seen that those so-called groups that the Saudi are using in Yemen and the new so-called president after Hadi, he's actually afraid even to go to work from Aden, and they show that they have as well failed politically. That's why what the Saudi actually now have in their pocket to have pressure on Yemen is the humanitarian crisis, because as we know that the Saudi is in control of the sky with the support of the United States and Britain and France and other Western countries, and as well they are enforcing a blockade on Yemen. They are not willing actually to give up on that weapons for Yemenis. They think that Yemenis will actually submit or give up and they will surrender. That's why we see that here Sana'a have asked the United Nations, they have asked for to reduce the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. They have asked for more flight from Sana'a airport to other destinations, like toward India and other countries where Yemeni seek medical help. And as well, they have asked to lift the blockade on Yemen, because what the Saudi doing now, actually, they are searching those fuel ships who are getting into Yemen many times, and then the United Nations will search those ships, and they will give those ships, especially oil tanker, a green light to enter Hodeidah port. And on the top of that, Saudi delays those ships for days and weeks and months, and this add actually cost to the fuel that is sold to Yemenis. And because Sana'a now is well equipped actually to take out all Saudi oil infrastructure, to take out all Saudi airport and as well Saudi port, and they can actually in a matter of one day that they can launch hundreds of ballistic missiles and drone attack and as well attack on Saudi ship in the sea. But still they are trying, they do want to make this war bigger. They are asking the Saudi symbolic that Yemeni oil revenue and gas revenue should be paid to all public sector across Yemen. They have not asked for something for themselves, what I mean, the Houthis. I mean, what they are going to use if there is more flight, especially as an example to India, do they think that Ansarullah commander or leaders will travel to India? I mean, they have nothing to do. The only thing that they have now to do is to protect Yemenis. And I think, I believe that if the Saudi will not meet those what Sana'a has asked, I'm sure. That in the coming days or weeks, that Sana'a actually, they will be fed up and they might launch a major attack on Saudi Arabia.
Indeed. They have to, obviously, the Saudi or the coalition, one or the other, has to watch out for whatever's left of it. Okay, you know, there's a problem that we have over here, and I think it's a matter of narratives that's being put out there when it comes to, for example, the issue of oil, which Hamza Karim, you mentioned, and also our guests are from Sana'a. Hossein Abouqaiti also mentioned, because the narrative, which is a false one that's out there based on the way that the UN has even described it, has said that the Ansarullah movement, again, a statement coming from the UN envoy, has hindered the Yemeni government's ability to export oil by launching drone attacks on terminals. Okay, this is what the UN is telling, actually, in a form of the UN session. This is what the UN representative said, that's what the Ansarullah movement, the official Yemeni army, is doing. But that's not the case, is it? Because from the viewpoint of the Yemeni government and the Yemeni army, that oil belongs to them, not to the Saudis, which are taking that oil, and then for that oil, the revenue generated from it, to land in a Saudi bank. So to them, that's the theft of the resource, oil. That's not how it's being portrayed. Am I incorrect to present this way? Is that not factual?
Yeah, so if you think about it, like, the oil in Yemen has been sold almost for the past 5-6 years. The money generated from this oil, where does it go? If the government, if the so-called government in the south of Yemen right now that is supported by Saudi Arabia is selling this oil, where's the money going? Why isn't the people in the south of Yemen and the people that are in the areas where it's controlled by Saudi Arabia and UAE not receiving even their salaries? So where's that money going? Is it going only to the officials that Saudi Arabia has, you know, put as government officials in these areas? Is it
which government officials? This war? Which government officials?
The so-called government officials.
Just want to make sure I'm clear on that. That's all.
Yeah, yeah. So Saudi Arabia have their own, you know, government that they've put in the south of Yemen that they're running the area there. This government, as Hussein mentioned, they can't even go back and operate from Aden because they don't feel safe there, because the groups that are supported by UAE, apparently they don't get along with the group that is supported by Saudi Arabia, so they can't even both go back to Aden and operate from there. Even then, this group, if the money is actually going to the pockets of these, you know, government officials that are installed by Saudi Arabia, why can't they pay the salaries for the people, at least the people in the south? Why can't they operate like the hospitals, get electricity? The people in the south of Yemen right now, they're actually suffering. They don't have electricity. They don't have gas. Gas prices are really high there. Exchange rate for USD to Yemeni rial is way higher than the north, where Ansarullah is controlling. And yet, what the government in Sana'a is asking for is that the revenue that is generated from this oil shouldn't go to Saudi's bank. This should be used by the Yemeni people, all the Yemeni people, the people in the north, the people in the south, the people in the west and the east. Salaries should be paid from this money. It can't just go to the Saudi's bank and you know, spend it. I don't know where.
Sure.
Maybe this war is even generated. Or maybe this war is even maybe funded by using this money. So imagine that Saudi Arabia is actually using Yemen's resources to fund the war in Yemen for Yemenis.
Exactly.
To invade Yemen.
Exactly. Hossein Abu Qaiti, I believe you had something to say on this. And may I add that aside from this, Saudi Arabia is generating anywhere from $750 million per day to up to $1 billion per day on its oil revenues, which I'm sure it can afford to at least pay for the humanitarian costs that Yemen is experiencing through the deaths and all the diseases that people are consumed with.
To be honest with you, if the Saudi will lift the blockade and will allow all Yemenis to use their oil revenues and gas revenues to pay the salaries, to buy whatever, will help Yemenis. Yemenis actually don't need any Saudi money. But as you mentioned, what the Saudi actually is doing, they are taking the revenue of Yemeni oil and gas, and then they are putting it in Saudi bank. Meanwhile, on the other hand, we see that Yemeni riyal currency has been crashing since the beginning of this war. That's why it has been actually clearly. Just I want to mention that after the Stockholm agreement, there was an agreement with Griffith, the former United Nations envoy to Yemen, that the Hodeidah revenue, which actually it could consider, I believe, a half. I mean, you cannot actually mention it. It's so small. If you compare it with what the Saudi is getting from the oil revenue, they have agreed with Sana'a and Griffith and the United Nations and the Saudi that the Hodeidah port revenue for those ships, fuel tanker, and as well, if there is any other ships coming to that port, will actually go to an account of Yemeni Central Bank in Hodeidah, and then the Saudi-backed forces will do the same. They will transfer all the oil revenue and gas revenue to the same account, and then the salaries will be paid according to 2014 payrolls. This means there isn't a single Houthi. If the Saudi afraid that this money for salaries will go to Houthi or Houthi fighters or Sana'a fighter, it will not go, because here Sana'a, they have agreed that those salaries will be paid according to 2014 payrolls list, which was actually the same list that the Hadi government, before he fled Yemen, was paying the Yemeni in the public sector. But still, the Saudi actually are refusing that. And if you see, on the other hand, when Saudi ask for a truce, they actually just want Yemeni to suffer, and on the other hand, they don't want to suffer. They are afraid of attacks on their oil revenue. But I'm sure that the United States and Britain is behind as well, Saudi, and behind their stand to continue this blockade and humanitarian pressure on Yemenis. I just want to mention as well, if you see that if the Saudi is calling for the truce, why the United Arab Emirates is still building bases and airport in Socotra, in Mion Island, in Bab el-Mandeb Strait? This show you that this actually they are building those bases for a longer occupation. They want to control Yemen's strategic island, Yemen's strategic Bab el-Mandeb Strait. So they are actually willing but they will do whatever it takes to save themselves from any attack from Sana'a. Meanwhile, Yemeni are suffering. But I believe that if Sana'a will not take a hard step against Saudi Arabia, because now they are actually bear the full responsibility of any civilians killed in Yemen because of the blockade, because they can actually stop it. Just one more last thing, very quick. Since this agreement was signed, there are 110 Yemeni civilians has been killed, and as well, more than 200 has been injured, especially in the border area of Yemen, because of the Saudi artillery shells and border bombardment.
Okay. Well, we only have 5 minutes left here. I want to catch up a little later on that point that you made about how the ports and the major, geographic areas of Yemen are being somewhat built by the UAE, and I believe Israel has a hand in there also, perhaps, like the Socotra Island. But before we get to that, Hamza Karim, I'd like to ask you about this deal with the governments as to the perception that there is. I mean, when it comes to how Saudi Arabia has dealt with the issue, it's really quite sad to see how they were pushing and supporting all out for Abu Rabah Mansour Hadi. But then they figured, you know what, maybe he is an impediment to peace. And then they went ahead and they formed this, I don't know if you recall, the Presidential Council, which they said they're going to be able to deal with what is going on in Yemen and perhaps move towards a solution. Now, the whole, I don't know what word to use. There's such hypocrisy in that approach, because when you take a look at Abu Mansur Hadi and how Saudi Arabia supported it, well, it was a one-man presidential election. There wasn't any contender. So that shows the hypocritical stance there. Then to get rid of him and then put a presidential council, none of these scenarios were backed by the majority of the population of Yemen. Isn't that a fact that's being overlooked here?
No, absolutely. And I think this is why the war started in the first place. So if you, as you mentioned, it was a one-man shop election, and Saudi Arabia was pushing for Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi to become the president back in 2012. And then earlier this year, they removed him from the scene and they put Rashad Al-Alimi. So if you think about it, really what happened is that Saudi Arabia is the one responsible for installing the bringing up the Yemen's president. And this is why the revolution happened in 2011, and then later on in 2014 was continued. And this is why the war started in Yemen, because Saudi Arabia can't stand seeing Yemen as a free country, as an independent country, as a country where its people are allowed and they get to choose their president. And that's why the war is still continuing till today, because Saudi Arabia see Yemen as a backyard. They think that Yemen cannot ever be, somewhere, free and independent and not under our arms. That sums up the whole thing that is happening in Yemen right now. Saudi Arabia wants, whoever will be ruling Yemen to be their puppet, to be someone who will get the orders from them. Otherwise, they're not willing to stop this crazy war, and they don't really care about what will happen to the civilians, how many people will be killed. Really, like for the past 8 years, everyone now should be convinced that Saudi Arabia don't really care about Yemenis. More than half, I think over half a million people in Yemen have been killed in this war because of the blockade, because of the, not allowing fuel ships to come in. 50% of the hospitals in Yemen now today are out of service because they don't have access to energy sources. So how can you justify that and say that Saudi Arabia is actually fighting for Yemenis in Yemen today?
Indeed. Well, Yemen's Ansarullah official, Hossein al-Buqaiti, Mohammed al-Buqaiti, I don't know if he's related to you or not. Anyways, he says that he expects an outbreak of a new round of violence to occur with this so-called Saudi coalition. And he has said that this outbreak is going to be different, this military outbreak is going to be different than the previous ones, because he said Sana'a has developed advanced missile and air capabilities. In how will it be different? What will they do? That's going to be, based on what I'm understanding here, an elevated response militarily to what is happening to in regards to the Saudis and the coalition.
If you see, since Sana'a forces has started launching ballistic missiles and drones and cruise missiles against Saudi Arabia, they started with Saudi military bases, and then after that they targeted some strategic infrastructure in Saudi Arabia, either oil infrastructure or other infrastructure, and then they have started to target Saudi military airport or as well civilian airport like south of Saudi Arabia, which part of it is used as military base. And after that, they have extended their attack by closing those airport, either a military airport or a civilian airport, and then they have extended their attack against Saudi port, either in Jeddah or Yanbu', and as well in Ras al-Tanura port in the Persian Gulf. And they attacked as well Saudi oil refinery and Saudi oil field. This means that Sana'a has actually sent a message that we can reach every corner of Saudi Arabia, everything. Well, that's why I believe that the coming attack, it will not be tens of ballistic missiles. It might be hundreds of ballistic missiles and drone attack against every Saudi military and oil infrastructure.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're going to have to end it there. Let me thank our guests, Hossein Abghaiti, activist and political commentator from Sana'a. Thank you so much. And Hamza Karim, Yemeni activist and political commentator from Toronto. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikko Vitavwe and the team, it's goodbye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., busloads of migrants were dropped over Christmas weekend near Vice President Kamala Harris's residence in Washington amid freezing temperatures, having traveled from the southwest border in Texas, immigrant aid groups said on Sunday, 25th of December. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website bdnews24.com has covered this story and tells us more. Texas has bused thousands of migrants to Washington, New York City, and Chicago in what some critics have labeled a stunt amid a national debate over the high levels of immigrant arrivals. Busloads of migrants were dropped over Christmas weekend near Vice President Kamala Harris's residence in Washington amid freezing temperatures. Having traveled from the southwest border in Texas, immigrant aid groups confirmed on Sunday, 25th of December. Approximately 110 to 130 of the migrants seeking asylum in the United States, many of them families with children, were placed on buses by Texas officials, said Tatiana Laborde, managing director of SAMU First Response, a relief agency working with the city of Washington, D.C. Tatiana Laborde said by phone that aid groups had been informed of their journey and awaited their arrival late on Saturday to hand out blankets and then transport them to a church in the city's Capitol Hill neighborhood. Aid to Texas Governor Greg Abbott were not available to comment on whether the state coordinated their transportation. The Republican governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, a vocal critic of the Biden administration's immigration policies, and some other Republican governors have been transporting migrants to democratically controlled cities in the northern United States. Texas has bused thousands of migrants to Washington, D.C., to New York City, and to Chicago, Illinois, in what critics have labeled a stunt amid a national debate over the high level of immigrant arrivals along the U.S. southern border with Mexico. Tatiana Laborde said that in the past week, 9 busloads of migrants have been dropped off in Washington. Lately, what we've been seeing is an increase in people from Ecuador and Colombia, Laborde said. Previously, many Venezuelans had been arriving by bus, she added. Many of the most recent arrivals, Tatiana Laborde said, are now attempting to go to New York or onward to New Jersey, where they have relatives or other community support. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. Three busloads of migrants were dropped off outside the Washington, D.C. home of U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris late on Christmas Eve, the latest episode in an escalating battle between the Joe Biden White House and the governors of Southern Republican states over federal immigration policy. The Central and South American migrants, believed to be sent from Texas, were dropped off in below-freezing temperatures, with some wearing only sweatshirts and shorts. Texas's far-right governor, Greg Abbott, has previously sent buses to Harris's Naval Observatory home. An organizer with the Migrant Solidarity Mutual Aid Network, Amy Fisher, told local news station ABC7 that Greg Abbott orchestrated the drop-off as a political stunt. It really does show the cruelty behind Texas Governor Greg Abbott and his insistence on continuing to bus people here without care about people arriving late at night on Christmas Eve when the weather is so cold, Fisher said. The group took the travelers to the shelter of a local church where they were given warm food and clothes. Tatiana Laborde with SAMU First Response, an aid group that was also there to meet the buses, said similar drops have been made in Washington since April. Christmas Eve and freezing cold weather is no different, Laborde told CNN. We're always here welcoming folks with open arms. The arrivals were the latest salvo in an effort by Greg Abbott to force the Biden administration to step up immigration controls at the U.S. border with Mexico. Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis and Arizona's Governor Doug Ducey have also transported migrants to cities that are run by Democrats. You and your administration must stop the lie that the border is secure and instead immediately deploy federal assets to address the dire problems you have caused, Greg Abbott wrote in a letter to Joe Biden last week. Greg Abbott added, you must execute the duties that the U.S. Constitution mandates you perform and secure the southern border before more innocent lives are lost. On Friday, U.S. Customs and Border Protection reported that 233,740 migrants were apprehended at the southern border with Mexico in November, marking the highest number ever recorded for the month. The border agency reported that 204,000 unique encounters, 35%, were from Cuba and Nicaragua. In a statement released on Saturday, the Federal Homeland Security Department said it continues to fully enforce our immigration and public health laws at the border with Mexico. As temperatures remain dangerously low all along the border, no one should put their lives in the hands of smugglers or risk life and limb attempting to cross only to be returned, the Department of Homeland Security added, warning that anyone attempting to enter the United States without authorization is subject to expulsion under the policy known as Title 42. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court temporarily suspended the expiration of the policy, empowering border officials to turn away asylum seekers on public health grounds. The Trump White House imposed it during the early phases of the COVID-19 pandemic. Days before Title 42 was due to expire, the border city of El Paso, Texas, declared a state of emergency after migrant numbers surged. If allowed to expire, Greg Abbott has warned that the number of people entering the United States illegally will only increase.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.